Because you listen to this show, I'm going to assume that, like me, you're a person who's fascinated by scientific and philosophical questions. So I wanted to tell you about another show I've discovered recently, the addictive, eye-opening, mind-bending podcast series, The End of the World with Josh Clark. Josh Clark is co-host of the absorbing Stuff You Should Know podcast. And for The End of the World, he dives into existential risks, ways we humans might accidentally wipe ourselves out with the same technology we're developing now in the hope that it will make a bright future for us. For example, how a haphazard physics experiment could end the universe, or why artificial intelligence could take control of the world, or how an artificially mutated virus could escape a lab and create a global pandemic. This is serious stuff for sure, but The End of the World delivers the fascinating science behind existential risks through an immersive experience with a beautiful original score and cinematic sound design that takes you from a spacecraft trying to navigate interstellar space to deep inside your body to the far future where humans have evolved into a post-biological species who live in digital form. The End of the World with Josh Clark is waiting to take you on an adventure. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Why not listen to all 10 episodes now and join the conversation on social media with hashtag EOTWJoshClark. Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading researchers at the University of Oxford. Our first series is all about artificial intelligence. I'm Peter Millikan, Professor of Philosophy. Welcome to the Thomas Hobbes Room at Hertford College. So far in this series, we've heard that artificial intelligence is becoming ubiquitous and is already changing our lives in many ways, from how we search for and receive information, to how it is used to improve our health and the nature of how we work. We've already taken a step into the past and explored the history of artificial intelligence, but now it's time to look forward. Many philosophers and writers over the centuries have discussed the difficult ethical choices that arise in our lives. As we hand some of these choices over to machines, are we confident that they will reach conclusions that we can accept? Can or should a human always be in control of an artificial intelligence? And can we train automated systems to avoid catastrophic failures that humans might avoid instinctively? Could artificial intelligence present an extreme or even an existential threat to our future? With me to discuss this are Alan Defoe, Director of the Centre for the Governance of AI at the Future of Humanity Institute, Mike Osborne, Co-Director of the Oxford Martin Programme on Technology and Employment, who joined us previously to discuss how AI might change how we work, and Jade Leung, Head of Partnerships and a researcher with the Centre for the Governance of AI. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Alan, let's start with you. What sort of extreme or existential risks do you think artificial intelligence might pose in the future?
So AI seems like it could be a powerful technology on the order of the technologies that generated the Industrial Revolution. And such a potent technology will have extreme impacts, both potentially very positive and very negative. So in terms of the risks that we see really on the near-term horizon, there's a number of them. First, the possibility of massive labor displacement, inequality. These are issues we're already sort of confronting in the world, and it seems like AI could amplify the economic processes that are generating these risks. There's plausibly going to be an increase in concentration of wealth globally. AI enables digital services to be more valuable, and digital services seem to have this property of generating a natural global monopoly, because for any sort of service area where anyone in the world could be a consumer, because the provision of the service is usually very cheap, there's sort of almost zero marginal cost, like using Google Maps, say, then that leads to competition and fixed costs, which generates this winner-take-all dynamic in industries. Okay, there's several more. AI is changing strategic stability and possibly undermining it. That's the risk that two countries might fall into a nuclear war, even though they don't want it. And I could say more about that. And then more generally, AI seems like it's going to be changing the character of military power, which is obviously something that countries are very concerned about, great powers especially, and could generate risks associated with it. One final risk is actually an opportunity in disguise. The risk is that because AI is potentially very disruptive, it could generate fears and anxieties and regulatory backlashes and reactions that impede the innovation of producing future AI applications, which would potentially rob us of the advances that AI would otherwise bring. So these might be in health, in education, in environmental sustainability, and so forth.
One topic you didn't mention there is the worries about superintelligence, the idea that we might develop an artificial intelligence which gets so far beyond our capabilities that effectively it starts taking over the whole show. And there have been some worries raised recently about that, notably by Nick Bostrom, who's here in Oxford. What's your impression about those kinds of worries?
So I think it's a useful thought exercise to imagine a machine that is more intelligent than all humans at everything to a vast extent, you know, analogous to humans versus, say, rats or even children, and think, what would that mean for our ability to govern the world the way we want it? And it clearly would pose a challenge in the same way that, you know, if you use this analogy, imagine a world of six-year-olds and you being the one adult in the world. And you begin as sort of the servant of these six-year-olds, but you're clever, right? And so you can find ways, divide and conquer. You might show them how you can help them stay warm and get food, and then they start to trust you. And so it's easy to see how there's a real challenge of control if this agent that's much more intelligent isn't fully aligned with the goals of the principal. This would be the six-year-olds or us as humanity. So this is an active problem in deep learning, machine learning, AI research called AI safety or AI alignment, which is, how do you build an advanced system that does what the human actually wants it to do and intends it to do and doesn't, say, learn the wrong, incorrect reward function? So we could talk a lot about this one approach where you say, let's imagine this superintelligence and then think about the challenges to us. But there's another way we can approach the problem, which is just start where we are today and imagine going forward as we start deploying these systems that are, they operate faster than humans can react. So already this is true on the stock market, and we start deploying machines in more and more domains that have really consequential implications. So it could be, you know, do you get the job? Is your self-driving car behaving correctly? But eventually it can scale much further to, is the energy system operating correctly? Are cyber defenses operating correctly? And maybe I think this is a useful way in, is to think about cyber defense and cyber offense in a world where machines are the only things capable of acting fast enough to be effective. So now we're in a world where humans design the systems and they train the systems. Maybe they don't even fully understand how the systems work, which is already currently a problem with machine learning. We find ourselves in this sort of incentive situation, the problem, where we don't have the luxury of waiting, say, 3 years to make sure we understand our latest generation of cyber defense system. We have to deploy it, else the adversary, you know, get an advantage on us. And in such a dynamic, we could find ourselves in the world where we don't know how robust our cyber systems are. We don't know what the risks are of a cyber flash crash or cyber flash escalation, where the sort of two cyber networks might, for hard to explain reasons, escalate rapidly. And the same might be true for financial systems, for these sort of fat tail risks of, say, self-driving cars being hackable at scale. The more we become dependent on intelligent machines that are hard for us to understand, just the higher the stakes are for us to really understand them, to control them, to govern them.
We've got plenty to worry about long before we get to the stage of super intelligent machines with minds of their own. Speaking as a philosopher, I have to say I think it's a fundamental mistake to think that somehow, as you put more and more so-called intelligence into machines, at some point they're suddenly going to become conscious and start having wills of their own. There's no reason whatever to suppose that that's going to happen. But it seems much more plausible, as you say, that humans using machines as tools to make their own decisions, needing to entrust them to machines for considerations like speed and so on, might bring about a massive instability. Jade, Would you like to give us your perspective on these kinds of risks?
Sure. I think a brief comment on the superintelligence point. I think it's a common mistake to assume that the argument about superintelligence assumes consciousness exists within the intelligent agent. And maybe a different way of framing the problem, which encapsulates a lot more of these risks that we've talked about, is thinking about it as transformative artificial intelligence. So whatever way the system looks, you assume that it's got a number of advanced capabilities which can generate these transformative implications, which can be both hugely good and hugely bad. And I think there is part of the superintelligence argument kind of breaks down into a number of problems, and we call them the control problem and the alignment problem. And if we just focus on those two terms, I think also you can see a number of control problems that we have with existing artificial intelligence systems, or very plausibly going to exist artificial intelligence systems. And also the alignment problem is a similar one, where you can see it manifesting in existing systems today. And so our inability to potentially control the way these systems operate, our potential inability to align them with the way that we want them to behave, those two fundamental problems about these systems that are very capable in some ways, but maybe we just haven't foreseen the way that they would all operate when deployed, I think that seeds a number of the risks that we currently see.
Could you give a few examples of what you mean by the transformative factors and the control and alignment problems, maybe in particular domains where those might arise?
Sure. Maybe let's focus on the use of artificial intelligence when it comes to being integrated into military systems. So I think that's something where you can see a lot of intention to do that, and a lot of existing actors are doing that today. So it's a very plausible and existing application of artificial intelligence systems. And I think it can be transformative for military capabilities. To what Alan said before, it can speed up the way in which these systems operate. And so the more speed advantage that you have when deployed on the field, that gives you an advantage over the adversary on a lot of different dimensions. Cyber is a very canonical example of this, but I think you can talk about this as well, just in terms of robotics and a bunch of different things. So it's transformative in terms of its ability to enhance the military capabilities of, say, a state actor or a non-state actor. But in terms of our ability to control a said military system, if a system is deployed and, say, we haven't deployed it in that given kind of active combat theater environment when testing it, say the data set that was used to train it didn't encapsulate a set of environmental factors that they're exposed to, then it could behave in a way that is unexpected and undesirable. It could potentially cause maybe more casualties than we wanted to calibrate it to do. And again, if it's an automated system, or in some circles we call it a human out of the loop system, so you don't have the ability for human to intervene and change the way the system is operating when it's already been deployed, that means we've lost control, quote unquote, of the system. And so that's an example of a control problem manifesting for a transformative military system that has artificial intelligence baked into it.
With more mundane uses of artificial intelligence, I mean, take self-driving cars. They're being tested hundreds of thousands of times. Now, with military weapons and so forth, you haven't got the same capacity for testing things. So isn't it a virtual certainty that they're going to act in unexpected ways?
We have an incentive to test autonomous vehicles because they're everywhere. A lot of consumers use them. You have a lot of existing regulation around the way that vehicle systems are tested before they're deployed. And so we have incentives and regulatory mechanisms that kind of force us as a society to make sure those are tested. And one of the risks when you talk about whether we are robustly testing these systems enough, say in the military domain, is this kind of race dynamic that can exist when you're in such a rush to deploy an advanced system that plausibly some governments or some militaries will cut corners on this testing so that you can realize the strategic advantage by deploying the system early. I wouldn't say it's a certainty, and we don't want it to be a certainty that these systems aren't tested well. But I think, again, this is kind of where governance comes in as a really important component, or a really important ingredient, to make sure that we don't incentivize actors to cut these corners and that we're making sure that any systems that are deployed are done so in as robust a way as we're testing autonomous vehicles, for example.
Isn't there a serious problem here? If you're talking about using machine learning in the battlefield, machine learning algorithms notoriously are rather opaque. We can't understand exactly why they're making the decisions they do. If we apply those systems elsewhere, we find that we need to do lots and lots and lots of training before they get really robust and reliable. We simply cannot do that on the battlefield, right? We can't test them in real battle situations. I'm reminded of a very funny episode of Yes Minister many years ago when Sir Humphrey was explaining to Jim Hacker about torpedo systems. Basically, none of the new torpedoes could be guaranteed to work because there hadn't been the opportunity to test them. And Hacker says, well, don't we have any torpedoes that work? Yes, lots, Minister, but they're the old Second World War ones because there was lots of chance of testing. And now I don't know how much that was based on, you know, real insight to military technology at the time, but it sounds fairly plausible, doesn't it? That so how is it seriously dangerous bringing machine intelligence into battlefield weapons at all?
I think you're gesturing towards a really important problem, which is this difficulty of making any sense of a guarantee that a system is going to behave in a certain way. One maybe useful way of breaking down this difficulty too is I think there's the technical difficulty of it, and there's also the kind of societal governance difficulty aspect of it. The technical difficulty I might punt to Mike, but I'll say that there is a fair amount that's being done. There needs to be more done, but there's a fair amount of work that's starting to emerge around making these systems more explainable and making them more robust under different kind of environments. And this broadly falls into this category of AI safety research, and there needs to be a lot more done on it relative to AI capabilities research. But that is certainly an area of research which there are some threads that you can pull on that seem tractable. I think the kind of difficulty when it comes to the societal decisions that we need to make is what do we consider safe enough in order to deploy? And I think the thing we always want to bear in mind is that there is nothing like 100% guarantee for technical systems that we currently use day to day. And we make a decision as a society that, like, below a certain threshold, we're happy operating with it in our everyday lives.
And presumably in the case of a weapon, since you're dealing with an enemy who cannot be relied on to respect any guidelines you suggest, you actually are pretty much forced to go ahead and deploy and to some extent hope.
Yes, but I think you can change some of the parameters of how much you're incentivized to just deploy by trying to mitigate or enforce, say, for example, an international law norm that autonomous systems, when deployed, should operate under a commonly understood set of standards of safety or something like that.
Mike, you do a lot related to control of machine learning systems and so forth. What's your perspective?
To begin, I broadly agree with everything that's been said, but let me try and push a little bit on the things that I perhaps disagree with a little. So, I mean, the first thing to be clear is that AI is not a single thing, right? AI is this broad basket of different technologies. And to some degree, I think it's important to distinguish those when we're talking about the difficulty of control. So for instance, there are aspects of military technology that rely on quite mature machine learning. So for instance, setting military technology aside, let's talk about autonomous vehicles. So the problem of distinguishing how far a vehicle is from another object is not so difficult in some senses. It's something that a lot of data can be provided to train an algorithm. It's something that even to some degree formal guarantees can be provided for. So it could be that even in contested military spaces, there are aspects of the problem that can be carved off that we can provide really quite strong control for. And the crucial question is not how controllable an algorithm is on an absolute scale, but how controllable it is relative to the current alternative, right? So in some cases, we're using humans to make decisions in the case of driving a vehicle or on the battlefield in which humans are not particularly well qualified. So for instance, while I'm certainly not an advocate for the use of machine learning in war, obviously human contestants are subject to mistakes like friendly fire that it might be possible to completely eliminate through the use of relatively simple technology. Perhaps everyone can wear a little device that indicates I am definitely a friendly combatant, please don't target me. So, you know, I think at all points we have to say not how good an algorithm is in absolute, but, you know, how much better or worse it is to the current state of play.
So we've been talking there about what you called the control problem, Jade, but there's also the alignment problem. And I take it the alignment problem is aligning what the purposes of the machine are with our own. Alan?
So there isn't a consensus on how to use these terms, but I'll offer my preferred terminology. I would say we want systems that do what we want them to do, and which we might call safe systems. So we want this property safety. And there's a few ways you can make a system safe. You can control it, which I understand to mean there's some human who imposes structure on the system, either sort of hard-coded rules that say you can't leave this boundary of safe behavior. And that gives us safety. You can actually cripple the system. So you can make this system weaker than it otherwise would be, because if you give it too much power, it becomes too dangerous. So maybe you slow down the algorithmic bots, or you, with the autonomous weapon system, you require that some human key is provided before an order to fire is given. So you make the system less capable in some sense, but more controlled by a broader governance structure. And then there's a third strategy where you align the goals of the system with the goals of the principle. This gets at the idea of what does the machine want? What is its reward function? And is it aligned, correlated with the goals, the utility function of the principle?
The principle meaning?
The person who owns the system.
The commander or whatever.
The commander, the person who bought the car, whoever is authorized by society to be the entity that decides how the machine should work. So those are three different strategies. Control, where you build some sort of human understandable system of almost sort of physical control around the system so it doesn't misbehave. Crippling, where you deprive the system of sufficient power that it's so it can't make these large, costly mistakes. And then alignment, where you allow it maybe to be extremely powerful and you don't control it, but instead you say, I want the system to want what I want. And there's lots of challenges getting alignment to work.
Well, can you explain what some of those challenges are?
Sure. And this comes back a little bit to the comment you made earlier about will machines ever have sort of a will of their own? And I would say they already do today. So machine learning, if you think about the history of AI, at the beginning, there was good old-fashioned AI, where there were programmers who wrote some program, type hello world, you know, with a loop. Or here's an expert system where the expert says, this is how I want you to diagnose a disease. And then the machine does it faster, more reliably than the human. We have now entered this new realm of machine learning, and especially deep learning, where we have enough data and we have flexible enough algorithms and powerful enough computers that machines can solve problems in ways that the human experts don't even understand. Machines can learn to identify objects, to classify images, to play chess or Go with no human input at a superhuman level. And it does this because it's able to either generate enough data, in the case of gameplay, by playing itself, or in the case of classifying images, by being given enough images that are labeled. Now, the thing is, what does the machine will in those cases? We don't know, because we don't give it a hard-coded utility function. So there's some kind of implicit will. And the implicit will is it's trying to get reward according to its training process. And so in the case of correctly categorizing images, that's relatively easy to understand because, if you will, the data distribution was static. You know, here's this distribution of images. There's some loss function, so it gets some reward or penalty for correctly classifying images. And then it wills, to the extent that it has a will, it wills to correctly classify images according to that loss function.
Well, I'm going to pick you up a little bit on this to the extent that it has a will. One might very much doubt whether it actually has any will at all. What you're saying is it behaves as if it did. Right. And when you talk about a reward function, I take it you don't mean that it's making it happy. You mean that there is some function being fed into it for which it's optimizing or something like that, right? I mean, it's trying to maximize the value of some function.
So I might ask you, what do you mean by saying that an entity has a will?
That's a very difficult and profound question. But what I would say is the computer does not have a will in the way that I do or you do, right? It doesn't have desires. It may act as though it has desires. We may decide to use the word desire metaphorically of it. But I don't believe that when, you know, suppose I write a program that plays a game, I don't believe that that program is getting any genuine pleasure from winning the game.
So humans evolved in a certain landscape, right? An ancestral savanna landscape where the reward function was a little bit different than what current algorithms are being rewarded for, right? For us, it was sort of fitness, survival, reproduction. And through that process, we have this really complex algorithm in our head that makes us feel desires and have very competing desires, curiosity, power, love, happiness, comfort, and so forth. I will continue to go on, but maybe I'll first turn it back to you and say, what would be sort of a Turing test for a machine that would differentiate its will from a human will? What is the observable distinction you can make between the machine's as-if will and a human's actual will?
Well, I think the line I would have is this. When the computer works in a particular way, say, playing a game, I've written a program for it to play a game. I know why it is making the moves that it is. It's doing it because it's been programmed that way. I have no reason whatever for postulating any conscious intention in the machine or anything like that. Whereas I know from my own case that the way nature has made me work the way I do is through a lot of internal feelings, drives, desires, ambitions, etc. So I'm not going to allow the Turing test as a legitimate test of whether the machine has such things, because I know very well that it doesn't.
Okay, so a few things. The first point will be machines today aren't programmed. They are trained, or sort of advanced software, that, or AI, through reinforcement learning, is not programmed. So if you think of AlphaZero, which was the final iteration of the AlphaGo, AlphaGo Zero, and then AlphaZero, this is the machine that taught itself to play chess in something like 8 clock hours to a superhuman level.
I think it was 4, actually. Remarkable. Yeah.
The humans didn't program it, and humans don't understand what it's thinking. Mm-hmm. We're trying to. Chess masters love AlphaZero, and Go masters love AlphaGo for this, because it's changed the game. It's playing new moves that makes them think in a new way about their passion, right? This is their calling. So we don't understand how it's thinking.
May I interrupt at this point? I feel I have to point out that these algorithms are not absent the imprint of their human designers. Right. It's not true that we have a complete black box that, given any problem, any data set, will learn to succeed at the associated task. I mean, AlphaZero is a result of human designers injecting a particular bias, a particular goal within it. I mean, so to some degree, of course, they are responsive to the environment, to the, you know, the external world through the presence of data, but they are still nonetheless things for which human designers should take responsibility.
So I think we're conflating a few things. Responsibility is separate from whether intentionality was encoded into it. And I think in the case of AlphaZero, the programmers design the architecture, and then they design the learning curriculum, and then the machine learns. But in the same way that, you know, my son is learning through school, it's not that his insights are the sort of handcrafted product of teachers and parents. He's learning his own insights about the world. And so in the same way, machines today of this deep learning variety are coming up with concepts and insights that no human ever had. And that's maybe the first point to the question of the Turing test. But maybe the second one is, I don't think you can evade the Turing test by just saying, I reject it. I think another way of characterizing this is, what is the scientific evidence that would tell you you are wrong? And if you can't articulate what that would look like, then it's not a scientific proposition.
So you're appealing to Karl Popper's idea here of falsifiability. If I can't falsify a claim, then it's not a proper scientific claim if there is no conceivable circumstances in which it could be falsified. I mean, it seems to me that the nature of consciousness and the things that go along with that is very mysterious. It's something we don't understand very well at all. And now that's not surprising. Okay, I mean, we only know about the genetic code for, what, 50 years, 60 years or so. Our understanding of the biological basis of the brain is very inadequate. We're learning more and more about it. So what I would say is that with these algorithms, the learning algorithms, we do have a general idea of how they're working. I mean, I accept entirely what you say, that you can write a program where the program learns, say, to play a game better than you could yourself, and it, in a sense, learns new rules for playing it. Sure, but it's doing that by following an algorithm which we have put into it, knowing that that is what it's going to lead to. The hypothesis that there's some sort of consciousness inside the machine which is leading it to work in the way it does is completely unnecessary. It's gratuitous. There's no reason whatever for supposing any consciousness, because it's not required to explain what's going on. Whereas in our case, that's quite different. And in the case of other comparable animals, it's quite different. Would you disagree with that?
So you'll maybe note, I haven't said consciousness yet, because I don't think that term is, well, it's very confusing. It means many different things. And I don't think it's that necessarily useful. I thought the noun concept will was sufficient. The idea that the machine wants something, there's sort of an implicit goal.
An implicit goal. I'm happy with an implicit goal. What I'm unhappy with is the idea that by developing a superintelligence, we might end up with something like the Terminator scenario, where we have systems that become more and more sophisticated and complex, and then suddenly the system becomes self-aware and it decides it wants to do away with this all. I just don't see that.
You don't need the emergent consciousness, this kind of anthropomorphic slave that throws over the shackles of its oppressor and kind of wants its own thing. I think it's enough to allow that the machine doesn't necessarily want exactly what we want.
Right.
It's reasonable to believe that in part because we don't know what we want, right? So as machines scale up in power and as we deploy them throughout the world, they are optimizing for some goal. And if that goal isn't what we actually want it to optimize for, then we'll end up somewhere we don't want it to be. And it can lead to people dying, but I think that tends to generate sort of these science fiction scenarios that aren't as productive. I want to offer some examples that kind of illustrate how the machines have will of their own today. So you see this, and there's a range of examples of machine learning algorithms that sort of learn the wrong lesson from the programmer's intentions. And for now, they're cute and fun. It's like, oh, look at that. So one of my favorite examples is a tic-tac-toe algorithm that was playing some kind of large space tic-tac-toe game. So it wasn't just the normal 3x3. And it was an evolutionary algorithm. So it learned by playing and experimenting. And one of the winning algorithms won in a way that wasn't easily to understand from outside. So they looked at what was happening. And it turns out it was deploying a logic bomb. Because the X and Y coordinates went off to infinity, it would choose values to place its X that were so far outside of the normal range that the other algorithm didn't have sort of proper memory management for that. And the other algorithm would crash and then it would win by default. Which is, you know, it's correctly optimizing for its goal, its reward function there, which is to right. win the game yeah. in the case where timing out means you lose. That's one example. There's a few other fun examples. A Tetris playing algorithm that, you know, gets a loss if it loses. And it turns out they didn't specify what happens when you pause. So the agent learned to pause when it was about to lose.
Right.
Which is, again, a sort of a clever hack to avoid, you know, the loss.
Yeah.
There's this boat racing example where the agent was rewarded for collecting points, which the programmers thought would lead it to drive around in the circle because points are sort of laid out along the track. But there was this one little corner where there was a bunch of sort of regenerating points, and the boat learned instead to just go around in a circle in this place. So in all these cases, you have the agent learning a solution to the problem that was not what the programmers intended.
Yeah.
They're really clever and they're cute to observe, but these are simple, dumb programs today. And as we start deploying systems, you know, at scale, making billions of dollars, those sort of clever solutions that weren't what the principal intended, and in that case, the principal will be the government or, you know, the world's people, we might not no longer laugh about these clever solutions. And then just to finish this idea that an agent that is pursuing one goal will come up with sort of clever solutions along the way is now being deployed for unsupervised learning. That is learning where you're sort of just trying to figure out the world and solutions to almost any problem within the world rather than a specific targeted solution that the programmer initially intends. So if you can put an agent into a, say, virtual world, and instead of just trying to solve one problem, it basically solves all the problems. It walks around, it experiments, it figures out how the physics work, what the shape of the labyrinth is, and so forth. One of the strategies that's really working to achieve that is what's called intrinsic motivation, where you give the agent this internal drive for two things. One is curiosity, so to understand the world, to predict what it will see, to predict what will happen, to predict future states given its actions. And the other is sometimes called empowerment, but I think most clearly is just to call it power. It learns to develop its sort of its neural architecture, its skills, so that it can achieve whatever goals it wants. And the reason that's such a useful internal drive is that then you can layer on the reward at the end. So you have this agent that can basically achieve whatever you want it to. And so then you come along as Principal A and say, I want you to collect cherries, and it goes and collects cherries. But then I come along and say, I want you to, you know, collect whatever, apricots, and it does that. So this illustrates how an agent that's pursuing one sort of hardwired goal, in this case, curiosity or power, can along the way achieve many auxiliary benefits, which in these cases are what you actually want it to achieve.
Yeah, and you can see how an agent that's programmed to have power over a world, virtual or real, and is motivated by curiosity, might end up doing all sorts of appalling things just to find out what would happen. You know, I'm curious about what you look like inside, so I'm going to cut you open. But a common objection to the worry about superintelligence is that the machine learning tools usually are like idiot savant, right? They learn to do one thing extremely well. We program them so that they are able to do some recognition task, say, fantastically well. But they can't simultaneously be trained to do lots and lots of different tasks equally well. Is that the case?
That is broadly representative of the state of machine learning today, but it shouldn't be described as a sort of fundamental obstacle to the development of superintelligence, right? So we know of at least one pretty good algorithm for developing like truly intelligent agents. It's evolution. Like we know it's worked on the planet Earth to develop intelligences that are reasonably capable at least. So, you know, given enough computation, we could probably apply that same algorithm on a digital computer to produce something that is, you know, roughly comparable to human intelligence.
That sounds ever so like the optimism that's been periodically going around with artificial intelligence for many, many years. I mean, we've had waves of optimism and then it hits reality and it turns out to be much more difficult. At the moment, we have this wave of optimism about machine learning. But the problems that we have to solve to get anything comparable to the competence of a higher animal, let alone a human, that's way beyond anything that's technically achievable at the moment, isn't it?
So actually, I mostly agree with you because I think there is certainly a lot of hype in machine learning and the capabilities of today's algorithms are often overstated. But at the same time, we shouldn't overstate our own abilities, the abilities of humans. So as I was saying before, the important question is really how does a machine compare against a human? And I think in a lot of respects, humans are quite limited. And even a relatively simple algorithm that's better targeting what it is that's really wanted from a task could do a lot better job. So really the way that technology is likely to proceed is that we'll sort of carve up task space into these quite well-defined boxes, and within each of those little boxes we'll find a really good algorithmic alternative to whatever humans are doing today.
So this is assuming, though, that humans, we have a box of tools in our brain which can do various specific tasks. But actually one thing that's very noticeable about us and other animals is that we can deal with all sorts of situations which may initially seem intermediate between things that we used to, and we deal pretty well with those. So we're kind of multi-purpose, aren't we? And is there on the horizon any way of dealing with that within machine learning?
So I'm firstly going to agree with you for the most part. So yes, it is absolutely true that machine learning today works only within these quite crisply defined boxes. We are very far from a truly general purpose intelligence. So to give just two examples where I don't think we're going to see autonomous intelligence anytime soon, creativity is still very far away. So certainly there are some algorithmic approaches to creativity today. They're very good at sort of churning out an endless sequence of creative objects. They're very bad at distinguishing the quality of those objects in that they're very poor at discerning what it is that humans actually value. Second of my examples is social intelligence, where, again, algorithms just don't have the data set that would correctly characterize everything that's going on in human social life. I think we will nonetheless make progress by eventually better understanding what it is that humans do, being able to describe it more crisply, finding these boxes that sort of tile the space of human capabilities, and with each of those boxes filling in the algorithmic alternative.
And all the spaces between the boxes. Alan?
I want to ask for clarification on what kinds of timeframes we're talking about here. So Mike said anytime soon. Others have said the foreseeable future, you know. But, you know, the history of working on AI is only several decades long.
True.
And I would say even if we're being extremely conservative in the sense that we don't think advanced general AI will come anytime soon, suppose we have 100 years, which seems, I would think, like a very long timeline. 100 years to prepare for the emergence of an entity that's more capable than us in every respect of intelligence. Actually, I'll take that 100 years, but even that is a huge task that we ought to take seriously. So, you know, we definitely shouldn't hyperventilate about it and splash on the cover of every Economist and Wired that AGI is you know, coming around the corner. But I think we should take it seriously. I think the challenge of this century, but if not the, if it's among the top, you know, five or so global challenges that we need to figure out how we are going to best maximize the upside and best reduce the downsides, because it could go either way to a very large extent. So one issue is whether it's coming soon, but another issue is whether we should take it seriously. And I would like us to take it seriously.
I think the one thing I'll chip in as well is we've spent a lot of time talking about the potential downsides and wanting to avoid all of these risks. But as Alan alluded to, there's a huge amount of opportunity to gain here if we get it right. And taking it seriously means making sure that we're navigating away from as many of the risks as we want to avoid, but also navigating more towards being able to use these kinds of systems to realize opportunities that we would want to gain. And as Mike alluded to as well, humans are often pretty bad, but we only have the benchmark that we have for us executing on certain tasks, and we don't perform particularly well on things like global coordination. We're not doing a terribly good job in climate change. So if we have the ability to design systems that can do a better set of things than we can, that's also one of many reasons that it's worth pursuing this challenge.
Right. Yes, when Alan was talking, I was thinking about climate change, actually, and he was suggesting we've got 100 years to prepare. I mean, the experience of both things to do with the climate, but also to do with Brexit, is that actually people's minds get concentrated as time gets shorter.
Mm-hmm, right.
And trying to motivate people to think seriously about problems hugely ahead just doesn't work. But on your more optimistic theme, I mean, is it possible that one of the best uses we could make of artificial intelligence in the nearer term is getting that to help us to think about how might we might cope with it in the longer term?
That's an interesting proposition. Yeah, I haven't thought a huge amount about that. Can you clarify what you mean by that? So, using artificial intelligence to help us better think about
how to plan. So one of the things we were worried about, and maybe it'd be good to say a little bit more about this, you were talking about strategic instability, Alan, about how as the various actors, the various states or whatever, are interacting using computers because computers can do things so much more quickly. It may be that in order to solve those sorts of problems, we actually need to use artificial intelligence to provide ourselves with tools that will enable us to make them tractable.
I could give a concrete example. So, I mean, certainly I think AI is useful in forecasting. So if we're trying to forecast technological progress, how capable AI is going to be by a particular time horizon, machine learning seems like a very useful tool. Before I stop speaking, I just wanted to give a massive endorsement to what Alan said earlier. And nothing I've said should be taken as any kind of contradiction to the need to focus very seriously on this issue of AI.
Yeah, maybe there's two senses in which we can use AI to solve our global challenges. The first sense, which I think is very compelling, is that AI will unlock these technological opportunities that then make our other problems easier to solve. So in the case of environmental sustainability, AI could empower new kinds of, or generate new kinds of material sciences and new kinds of physics exploration through, so to give a little bit more texture, if we can simulate the physics environment, chemistry, with enough accuracy, we can then deploy reinforcement learning or just other kinds of brute force methods to discover new materials. And that could make more efficient batteries, more efficient solar cells, and so forth. More generally, economic growth is good for liberalism, it's good for global cooperation, and AI seems like it could be an empowering technology for all kinds of industries and economic improvement. So in that sense, AI might ease the tension, the economic and environmental tension that we would otherwise face. And this is why I think the last risk I would like to mention is the risk that we fail to achieve the innovations from AI because we overreact, we have clumsy and ineffective responses to the very real challenges that AI brings. This is why we need to sort of both take AI seriously, but also in a prudent, calm manner so that we're not overreacting. A second sense in which AI might help us with our global challenges is if it helps us with our global political problems, helps us understand each other better, find solutions to difficult negotiations. And currently AI is pretty far at helping us with that. You can tell stories about how it could help. You can also tell stories about how it might make it more difficult. So just to offer one illustrative sort of science fiction possibility, which could be 5 years away, we might be able to soon infer the affect and intentions of a person remotely. So currently you can remotely read someone's respiration and perspiration without someone's consent. You can have a device in the room from which, if the person's not trained, you can infer something about their emotional state. If I ask you a question that's probing about something you shouldn't have done that you did do, and I see your heart rate spike, that can tell me something about, you know, your beliefs about that question. Also, it's plausible that visual cues can be used to understand something about what a person's thinking. So we could be in a world 5, 10, 15, maybe 20 years where it becomes very hard to lie or to hide your intentions and your thoughts at a crude level when in the physical presence of another person. That could transform diplomacy. Now, probably there'll be countermeasures, there'll be training you can do to protect it. Maybe diplomats wear masks, but that's just one example of really a wild card. It could take us in different directions.
I agree with the potential, but I'd recommend we proceed with very great caution along that direction, right? So, I mean, the rise of social networks, which has been largely underpinned by machine learning, was motivated by similar promises of the value of connecting people. And you can make many arguments to the fact that actually that's not been a net force for good.
Yeah. To clarify, my scenario wasn't meant to be utopia. It was meant to be dystopian / utopian. We don't know what it will do.
Didn't Douglas Adams postulate the Babel fish, which enabled all the different civilizations to talk to each other? And didn't that cause global calamity, wars and things? I believe so. Check on that, fact check before that goes in. I had in mind that a lot of problems of interaction come down to modes of operating socially. I mean, for example, voting systems, methods of negotiation, game theoretic problems, where we're not terribly good at those. And it might be that when we're dealing across the world as a whole, things get very complicated. And artificial intelligence might help us solve some of those problems in a good way. I mean, we've found many human institutions that help us to resolve all sorts of conflicts of interest and such like. And as those get more complicated, maybe machines will help us with that. But one of the biggest of those problems is going to be something that you raised at the beginning, Alan, about labour displacement and inequality and how to deal with concentrations of wealth and global monopolies and all that sort of thing, where we might need new legal structures. We might need new structures, say, of intellectual property and so on. Perhaps artificial intelligence could help us to do that sort of thing well. And Mike, we've already had a program where we've been talking a lot about this, but could you just briefly give us your perspective on that?
The first thing to say here is that working within machine learning, there's this kind of sample selection bias for the fact that I do believe that machine learning is likely to be enormously economically valuable, right? But the way that value plays out in society is not necessarily for the benefit of all. So historically, we've seen technological transitions that have resulted in a great deal of efficiency gain, a lot of value created that hasn't necessarily accrued to the average worker. So in the English Industrial Revolution, the evidence we have suggests that it took maybe 60 to 70 years for the average worker to see any sustained wage growth. So the concern is that AI might lead to some sort of disenfranchisement of the average worker. Perhaps it's AI acting as a manager that's not responsive to the kind of things that we'd want a real human manager to be. Maybe it's AI directly substituting for a human worker. All of these things are going to need to be thought about in much greater depth before we'd, you know, really be willing to be confident about the future labour markets in our societies.
So do you think there's a risk that in the future, as some people have suggested, you may get a kind of class divide between those who know about and are able to utilise artificial intelligence and those who don't?
Technology is political. So, I mean, we shouldn't view this sort of future trajectory lying ahead of us as entirely technologically determined, right? I would agree that there is a possible trajectory in which technology disenfranchises a large number of workers, those who are perhaps least well equipped to be complemented by developments in machine learning. But there are other scenarios in which, you know, machine learning is a real boon to those workers. So I think it's really not a question of the technology. It's about the kind of things that my colleagues here in the room think about. How are these technologies governed and put into practice?
Could we look for some sort of utopian future where AI helps mankind in general to be fantastically productive?
Absolutely.
And the benefits of this are fairly distributed and we can all spend our time being creative and
right, so you can imagine a scenario in which somehow ownership of these algorithms is public and everyone is sort of benefiting from the value that they're creating. I'm not sure how we get to that point, but it's, you know, at least a nice thing to think about.
Yeah, and the development of AI can therefore perhaps prompt us to think in very positive ways about the development of our social structures.
Yeah, I mean, so to Alan's point earlier, a big concern is obviously a lack of economic growth, right? So one of the big concerns of recent decades has been the so-called productivity paradox. We're not getting as productive per year as we would otherwise want. Maybe AI, in allowing us to be more productive, tackles what is actually the larger issue on our table today.
We've talked quite a lot about awful things that could happen. We've talked a bit about really good things that could happen. What do we think is actually going to happen? Where and it's notoriously difficult to predict, but have a go. Jade?
I think the only thing that I'll go on record saying is that we have a lot of work to do, particularly when it comes to the governance, thinking through what governance outcomes we want to aim towards and putting in place the foundations and the pieces that we need to put in place now to ensure that we kind of follow that trajectory. I completely agree with the framing of this not as a technologically determined problem, but it's going to be informed by how this technology progresses, but all of the decisions that we make along the way of developing these systems and deploying these systems, those are decisions that we're making as a society. And there's this other whole host of problems, which is about who's making those decisions today and how we collectively keep those decisions accountable to how we want them to go. Current conversations that I think we need to be having is looking at where the decision makers are and what their incentives are currently and what they're being rewarded for. So for example, if you look at large technology firms who are developing a lot of these technologies today, we need to look at them as the bastions for kind of where a lot of this governance is going to be seated, because they're the ones making decisions about what technology is being developed and deployed. I think what we can look at now is looking at where this power is concentrated and then thinking through what the implications of that are and putting in place the right incentive structures to make sure those decisions kind of follow the routes that we want them to follow.
That's rather a difficult thing to do, isn't it, when those actors include large global technology companies who haven't seemed to be particularly keen on, say, paying their dues in the form of taxes.
Right.
And some of them include nation states, which we are not going to be able to control. Is that a worry?
You can choose to be worried about it. You can also choose to be optimistic about it. I think there's...
So give us the optimistic gloss.
So I think at the end of the day, companies... There are a number of examples historically where companies respond and private entities respond to public interests. There are often examples where it doesn't work quite as we want it to. But the point here being that these institutions that are designed either explicitly in the case of a government, e.g. via voting, or in the case of companies via more indirect routes, like the sentiment of the public affecting what kind of decisions they make because they're worried about share prices or whatnot. So there are ways in which, you know, we can channel our influence to these different entities. I think it's about kind of being deliberate about how those things are channeled.
And what about the fact that some of the competition is between nation states? Or
yeah.
Groups whose overall political or other orientations may be greatly at odds with each other.
Generally, the whole competitive landscape, I think, between these various actors who have this incentive to just want to create more powerful artificial intelligence technologies is a worry. And so finding ways to kind of dissipate some of those competitive dynamics or channel them in better directions is the task. So I'm pointing towards a lot of things that we need to do.
Yes.
And that, but I think the point is that we have the capacity to do these things. They're not predetermined.
So there are some broad sunlit uplands that we could look forward to if all goes well. Mike?
I just wanted to bring up this analogy that I don't think we've discussed so far today that was kind of inherent in what Jade was just saying, which is that in a sense, the advent of companies is not a bad analogy to the advent of AI. So companies are themselves agents with some power that have some goals that are distinct from any individual human. But you know, we've, as a society, sort of adapted to the presence of companies, and we have laws and institutions that govern how they can act. And as Jade was saying, they seem actually to respond to many of the things that we as a broad society actually want. So maybe we'll be able to invent similar sort of institutions to govern AI as well.
Yes. And just to continue Mike's analogy, with companies, we've governed them pretty well. And it turns out this profit motive, as sort of Adam Smith foresaw, where each company is pursuing its own profit, given suitable regulations, leads to an emergent pursuit of society's interests as sort of a collective interest, but with some failure modes, right? Occasionally a company cheats on its emissions technology, right? So their society created a regulatory framework and the company wanted to maximize profit and found sort of a way of cheating, right? Optimizing that wasn't how society wanted it to optimize. Similar with, you know, cutting corners with environmental infrastructure and other assets. So in general, I think this analogy is useful for seeing both how we can succeed and the rich set of institutions for controlling, for aligning the incentives. Also, a nice thing with companies is we have often whistleblower processes where individuals within the company can kind of report what the company was thinking when it misbehaved. As we saw with the recent Facebook report in the New York Times, what Sheryl Sandberg said actually matters to the sort of culpability of this institution. And in the future, or in today, we can do that with AI. We can look at what neurons are firing. We can audit decisions and behavior of AI systems. However, the disanalogy starts in that companies today are very intelligent, perhaps smarter than any one human, but they're still composed, the sort of intelligent nodes within a company are humans with machines and protocols and bureaucracy. And so we're able to govern those with other combinations of humans and machines and bureaucracy. As we start deploying intelligent machines in those companies to make profit, we're, in the sense, going to need equally intelligent governance entities to make sure that companies are aligned with the common good, with the interest that we want it to be aligned with, and not pursuing some narrow or perverse interest.
Could you spell out why that would be? I mean, I can see that the way in which things work within some company might get very hard for us to understand. But the effect that the company is having on the world outside, isn't that going to be relatively straightforward to discern? You don't think so?
I think maybe a useful example would be Enron. So companies can blow up the financial system in a way that is hard to see from outside. So Enron, you know, they were the smartest guys in the room. They were the most innovative company for several years going, and they were innovative. They were really good at optimizing. In this case, they ended up optimizing for accounting shenanigans, and they just hid massive amounts of debt in these accounting black magic, which eventually exploded and, you know, had a ripple effect on the economy. So I think if you're a powerful entity of the size of a large company, and you're very smart, and you're smarter than your regulators, or more powerful than them, you can capture your regulators, you could do a lot of damage.
But you're talking largely about fraud, information, hiding the truth.
So it might not even be illegal when they start doing it, right? Yeah. So the pathologies that people point to with Facebook, there were no laws against creating a social medium in which people are being incentivized or sort of rewarded for anxiety or for political polarization. Facebook was just providing a product, and it turns out they had this sort of misaligned reward function that they wanted to maximize time on site or clicks. The sort of algorithm that achieves that, one of the sort of emotional states it puts you in is perhaps being anxious or insecure. So you keep going back to Facebook to seek validation, or it wants to keep you in your space of political obsession. So it shows you either outrageous news or news that caters to your worldview.
But in that case, I mean, the harm that can do has become obvious enough to us. We don't have to be clever enough to have dreamed up those methods ourselves, but we can see the harm they're doing. Are you suggesting that in the future, companies that are driven largely by AI may end up doing things where we can only identify the harm by ourselves using AI to do so?
They may at least have the harm they can do turbocharged by the advent of AI. So it may happen faster and at greater scale than it's been possible in the past.
Right, okay. I thought Alan was hinting that we might get a new degree of problem, something that where the turbocharged company would not only be doing things at greater scale than otherwise, but something that we simply can't detect.
Yeah, maybe one way to operationalize this in the near term is we might see this with concerns about fairness or auditability or just making decisions in a correct way. So as algorithms are being deployed in consequential domains with political, ethical implications, we may need other kinds of AI-type insights and solutions to govern them. So it's not just that we can, if we have the algorithm, a human can look at it. We may need a superior algorithm or protocols for inspecting algorithms or for proving that they behave according to certain properties. Right. So in that sense, governance needs to be as sophisticated with AI as the deployment of the systems in order to govern it well.
Well, that's a very nice note on which to end. It links back to an earlier podcast we had actually about fairness of algorithms, which was fascinating. But also it ends a little bit on an optimistic note that AI might provide some of the solution to its own problems, both in this respect and in those we've touched on earlier. Thank you all very much. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Alan, Jade and Mike for that fascinating discussion. And listener, I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. If you'd like to share your thoughts about our Future Makers podcast, why not leave us a review? And if you've liked this episode, please do give it a rating and let your friends know about the series. In our next episode, we'll find out whether China is now leading the way in artificial intelligence. I'm Peter Millikan. Thank you for joining me on Future Makers.
Hi there, Future Makers listeners.
Hello.
Steve and Ben here from the production team, just popping in to say that we hope you're enjoying listening to the show as much as we enjoy making it.
The episode you've just listened to has been kindly sponsored by the Exponential View podcast. In just a moment, its host and creator, Azim Azar, will talk to you about what you can expect from his excellent show.
After listening, why not give Future Makers a review? It's your chance to help steer the debate, and we really enjoy reading every one.
From politics and culture to business and the household, technology is transforming every aspect of our society. But the quality of debate around it isn't keeping pace with its exponential progress, and in order to shape technology for our own benefit, we need to be aware of how it's evolving. And that's the goal of the Exponential View podcast. Join me, Azim Azar, for weekly conversations with entrepreneurs, policymakers, technologists, and leading academics as we discuss the forces shaping our future. From artificial intelligence and the future of work to cybersecurity and the role of the state in innovation. Find the Exponential View podcast at www.exponentialview.co/podcast or just search for Exponential View on your favorite podcasting platform.